You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So last night we presented cosmologist Sean Carroll and writer Jim Holt on the topic, Why Does the World Exist? And I can't say that I understood everything they said, but my enjoyment increased as I surrendered to my disorientation, jolted into thoughts about my mortality and the dizzying youth age of our universe. I was alternately reassured and then dropped into the unfathomable. And I humbly suggest that that's one possible way to prepare yourself for a reading by Ann Carson. Prepare to be jolted. Prepare to plunge. Ann Carson is a professor of classics as well as a poet, essayist, and translator. And in an interview, she once said, not so unlike our cosmologist last night, that, quote, time is paper folded to look like a mountain. And as her works point simultaneously towards the past and the present, she shows us that what stands between contemporary readers and the ancient world only appears to be substantial. In addition to her many highly regarded translations of classical writers, Ann Carson has published poems, essays, libretti, prose criticism, and verse novels that often cross genres. But perhaps the most widely received examples of her particular specialty are her verse novels like Autobiography of Red, A Novel in Verse, and The Beauty of the Husband, a fictional essay in 29 Tangos. Her approach has won her awards like a MacArthur, a Guggenheim, and a Lannan, and an electric reputation in the literary world. But all that might be less relevant than knowing that she is a poet obsessed with volcanoes, that she once admitted that at heart she considers herself a visual rather than a verbal artist, and she grew up drawing pictures and writing on them, which I find fascinating. She eulogized her brother Michael in Knox, a translation of Catullus's poem, his own elegy for a brother, illustrated with collages, photographs, and scraps of letters, the pages folded accordion-like into a gray box suggesting a headstone. So tonight, Red Dock is the sequel, sort of, to Carson's most popular book, Autobiography of Red, a novel in verse, which retells the myth of Heracles and his 10th labor. And in Red Dock, we again meet Heracles, renamed Sad, who's now a warrior returned from some recent war, suffering post-traumatic stress. He and the red boy Geryon, now called G, head north on a road trip, check themselves into a psychiatric clinic nestled beside a glacial lake, and soon face yet another volcano. Events erupt out of nowhere. This is a poem about the past, about now when glaciers are melting, about art and about being human. Don't expect a plot. As one reviewer wrote, this sequence belongs to no earthly clock, but to one marking comet time. Look forward to the plunge. Please join me in welcoming Ann Carson.
Hi. I'm very happy to be here. I hope that soon enough you will be too. I'm going to read from a number of different forms of things, as was suggested in the introduction. I seem to like to use different forms for every different idea. I'm not sure why. It's kind of a character defect. So I'll start with the novel that Louise mentioned, Red Dock, Dock short for document. To forestall complicated interpretations of that, I'll just admit that Red Dock is the name that my computer gave to the file the first time I saved it, so I just thought, seems to work. So it's a novel about a red guy with wings, and by profession he's a herdsman. He has a herd of musk oxen, so I'll read a section about that, him herding. And in this section you meet Sad But Great, his friend who's back from the war. And, okay, it's a chapter called Typical Night Herding Songs Gallop. Typical night herding songs gallop their rhythms and tell of love. G doesn't usually sing to the herd at night. He may talk to them, listen, stand in the herd, listen. That community, a low purple listening, but with a height to the sound, them listening. They direct it up and out. They stand in a circle facing away from the center, and the long guard hairs hang down to brush their ankles like pines, like queens dressed in pines. Musk oxen are not, in fact, oxen, not castrated bulls, nor do their glands produce musk. Much is misnomer in our present way of grasping the world. But pines do always seem queenly as they sway so grand and anciently from the sky to the ground. Motion is part of listening. As the night goes on, let's say he's there for a number of hours, the motion changes. At first they just shudder a bit like any large entity come to rest, but gradually, imperially, they begin swaying. Then, as one rhythm, they pass the sway from shape to shape around the circle, its amplitude increasing, its warmth rising from knees to hearts to eyes, its pressures rolling across the large, loose joints of the shoulders and down the long bones of the hips until, at some point, with a phrasing as simple as a perfect aphorism, one of them spins up off its shanks and performs a 360-degree spin in air and returns to place, slotting itself into the undulation of the others as firmly as temptation into I can resist anything but. He slips from thought to thought. Wild, wild, wildness does surely attract him, although what he knows about wildness is not much. He knows with the oxen that they prefer common gorse to willow shoots and can balance the top heaviness of their bodies by plaiting their feet as they walk. While with Sad, he knows don't mention war play. Funny word, war play. Never says war or warfare. I've seen a lot of war play, he'd say. War play had me pumped those years. Tip of the spear, flip switch inside. She hit the ground, 75, saw the white bag, 75 bullets tore her head off. I saw her hand. I wasn't going to tell anyone back home about, oh, it found its way out, it surfaced. I had a tan when I came home, no wounds, no cuts. Everyone kissed me. Sure, I sat by the fire, I talked to the old man. There were the smells, the bone beneath. Sweat broke out on me at breakfast. I didn't expect to come home. That was not in the plan. Some point, I guess, the brain cells just give out. You read 100 military manuals, you won't find the word kill. They trick you into killing. You get over it, it's okay, you have to. Fear not tolerated. Take you out back and shoot you, they say. Her eyeglasses in the grass. Standard questionnaire? Fine, just say fine. Numb yourself. Wireframe eyeglasses. Does it feel good at first? Yes. Play, guns, fire, animals. You know, the Carthaginians like to use oxen for night fighting. I'm talking about Hannibal. I'm talking about the Battle of Ager-Falernus, 217 BC. Like tanks, but more frightening. They tie lit torches to the horns and stampede them toward the enemy. The Romans panicked. Some ran into the herd. Some got knocked off the path to the crags below. Others tried to retreat and were lost in the tundra, never seen again. But what about, I'm asking, what happens when the torches burn down? to the horn, to the hair, to the head, to the bone beneath. So much human cruelty is simply incidental, is simply brainless, simply no common sense. You could take the entirety of the common sense of humans and put it in the palm of your hand and still have room for your dick. Now let's meet Io. She is the lead musk ox. And here she's waking up in the morning. It washes her. It washes her up from the bottom. Slow fluids of dark slide past each other at different speeds. Light she ignores. Waking is gradual lines of dark into sounds. They line up. Before they do is a moment of terror happening every day she every day forgets. Dry little sound is a bird's neck bones sifting into place to sing. Its eyes open and widen. Birds with bigger eyes sing first. Rackety every day to hear this, every day forgets. A passing snake splits by. Reds leap the clouds in a wind, stirring everything tall all the way out over the river and pinwheeling back as the membrane cracks. Open, the heavens are perfect. Perfection sounds round. Good morning, good Io. Bird drops its note into the round and round the note goes, circling the wall of the world and stops. After stops is a gap she listens down into for someone who comes tack, tack, tacking along the... She hears tack, 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 slow down and eye and hesitate and tack, tack, tacking past. Someone insists and someone will hesitate at this hour. With the heavens perfect and all gazes wet and the bird drops another note into the round and round. Coolly every day, forget, forgetting all but this, not the difference between this and winter, does she long for it, winter, where waking is, where two cloven halves of her hooves clocked in ice and blood crisping along arteries at minus 23 degrees is a glory to her. Winter exists, and winter is never soon enough. She is awake. And now, one of the Greek choruses. The Greek chorus is called Wife of Brain. This seems to be one about sad. Wife of Brain. They drank bright mead in cups of gold. They drank bright mead to catch his shrieks. They drank bright mead, what kind of knife? They drank bright mead between his cheeks. They drank bright mead was the melody someone sang. You ever see a pig in the shape of a man, shook over hell and on you went, the teeth it shattered, the tongue it rent. You drank bright mead, and after bright mead you drank nightfall. You want to know more about those fellows, you'll have to buy the book. Okay, moving on. This is a poem I'm pleased to say I found on my computer the other day. I had forgotten it for 4 years. I wrote Harvard University once asked me to do a lecture on pronouns, so the idea of which bored me to tears, so I wrote a sonnet sequence instead of a lecture, and that was nice. It's like 15 sonnets. They were bewildered, but accepted it. But there was one that didn't get into the sequence, just didn't fit. And so it, you know, got stored on the computer somewhere. Anyway, it's a poem that mentions someone you might know, Calvin Watkins. He died just a few months ago. If you moved in the community of Indo-Europeanists, you would have known Cal Watkins. He was a very famous Indo-Europeanist and a professor of linguistics at Harvard. He also taught at UCLA. Nice guy. Anyway, so this mentions him and it's kind of in honor of him. Pronoun envy. Pronoun envy is a phrase coined by Cal Watkins, of the Harvard Linguistics Department in November 1971. To disparage certain concerns of the female students at Harvard Divinity School. In a world where God is he and everyone else mankind, what chance do we have for a bit of attention? Seemed to be their question. Cal Watkins, how patient a man, did not say, "You carry tale, mumble news, marplot, fine fault, spoil sports," but rather, that pronouns themselves were not to blame. It's the Indo-European system of markedness, a binary system, which regards masculine as the unmarked gender, as if all the creatures in the world were either zippers or olives, except way back in the Indus Valley in 5000 BC, we decided to call them zippers and non-zippers. By 1971, the non-zippers were getting restless. They began bringing kazoos to their lectures to drown out certain pronouns and masculine generics. Now, a kazoo is a toy, a noisemaker. It scrubs away the air in that place. What can you do with a piece of scrubbed away air? Various things. You can fill it with neologisms or with reanalysis. Or with exaptation. Let's explore exaptation. To exapt is to adapt in an outward direction. You may have seen pictures of a kind of dinosaur called the Archaeopteryx, which had feathers but did not fly. Its feathers kept the Archaeopteryx warm. Meanwhile, everywhere, ice was melting. Feathers for warmth became redundant. One night, the Archaeopteryx exapted its feathers as wings, and over the yards of Harvard rose divinity students in violent flight, changing everything, changing nothing, soaring and banking under the moon, intending, no doubt, to never come back. But of course, that proved impossible. They did come back. They finished their degrees. They used their wings to shoot pronouns around on a big hockey rink back of the divinity school. Night cold rushes onto my forehead and an area of emotion up under my tongue when I recall those games. But because a binary system uses numbers in base 2, requiring only 1 and 0 to express its differential, we had to score our games in scandal and sadness, in tungsten and long twisting streets, in bride habited, maiden hearted, thief stolen, wind led, marble constant, wonder wounded, to and fro conflicting, world without end marks of our own invention. And to this day, if you look behind the Harvard Divinity School, and if you know what to look for, you may see a slight residue of those nights. Here's what to look for. A pony standing quiet with one ear bent. He seems to have a bit of capture caught in it. He shakes his head and all around you, soaking the night and the yards and whatever is alienable or inalienable there, comes a smell like a new tuxedo. Thank you, Cal Watkins. Okay, another form. A few years ago, someone's phone is ringing. A few years ago, I wrote a TV show called Crap Hour. Hasn't been picked up by the major networks yet. Anyway, Crap Hour is a talk show with Samuel Beckett's character Crap as its host. And Crap interviews various people like Martin Heidegger, Antigone, a ghost. And in this segment, he's interviewing Helen of Troy. So you have to imagine, you know, the desk, the Johnny Carson desk with Crap sitting there. Enter Helen of Troy. Crap, what was it like where you grew up? Helen, I remember the rivers, We had four rivers in Argos. Oddly, I went to Troy and four rivers there too. Crap. A river is a beautiful thing. Helen. At Troy, when the girls came out of the river, their hair had turned to amber. Their tears were amber, if they had tears. And girls always have tears, don't they? Crap. What river was that? Helen. The Eridanus. Crap. You like Troy. Helen. All substances devour each other there. It's what war is. Crap. You caused the war. Helen. I did. Crap. Was it for love? Helen. Yes. Crap. So no regrets. Helen. I saw ghosts on the stairs. I could hardly bear to leave them there. Crap. What ghosts? Helen. The night Troy fell, I saw them like a window pane in flames. Crap. Those weren't ghosts. Helen. Perhaps not. Crap. You tell a lot of lies. Helen. Yes. Crap. Is this one? Helen. Yes. Crap. Why lie now? Helen. Just in case. Crap. Always ready to jump. Helen. Like a farm cat. Crap. Didn't Homer say that? Helen. Troy was not made of gold, you know. Speaking of lies, Homer invented the gold. They all preferred iron for cooking, for weapons. Crap. Is this important? Helen. Just felt like clearing it up. Oh, look. Crap. What? Helen. Snow starting. Snow in the trees. Look. Crap. Snow begins. Helen. My favorite thing was snow falling on the river. Do you feel calm? I do. Crap. Momentarily. Helen. Ask me something else. Crap. What was Paris like, or do you call him Alexander? Helen. I call him Fuck Fox. Adorable little pointy face, but he could so rip you to shreds. Crap, nice. Helen, you write poems? Crap, God, no. Helen, you look depressed. Crap, have I been asking you the right questions, do you think? Helen, yes. Crap, don't just say yes. Helen, it is the one thing I can't explain. Crap. What? Helen. How dear are my own limbs to me, and how I preserve them. Crap. Well, we all do that. Helen. Then there's no reason to interview me. Crap. Except I hear a kind of howl comes right out the middle of you. Helen. I'll tell you a story. The last day at Troy, they take all the women down to the beach, separate them into beautiful and not beautiful. The beautiful go off with certain of the Greek commanders. The others are told to dig their own graves, which they do, which I watch. Crap. Go on. Helen. Along comes a Greek captain, or maybe he was a general. The Greeks call everybody king. I never got the rank straight. Anyway, I'm standing on the wall with my dog, a little rat terrier. I've had him since before the war. Name is Pops. And the captain all of a sudden has Pops by the scruff of the neck and a dagger out saying, "How about we trade this dog for those women?" And he lays his dagger along Pops' throat. Crap. Silent four beats. Helen. He offers me an exchange. Crap. Silent four beats. Helen. I take the dog. Crap. Silent three beats. Homer calls human beings ephemeroi, doesn't he? The ephemeral ones. Helen. Yes. Crap. It means creatures who live but a day. Helen. Yes. Crap. Maybe that's just about long enough for us. Helen. I'm so not arguing. Crap. Short break. Don't go away. The crap theme song. Helen moves down couch. Snow continues to fall. Would have been a great show. Okay, one more form. This is an essay, sort of, but it had the following occasion. Some years ago, I decided to read Proust, and I've read it in French. I read it for about a half an hour every morning when I was eating my millet flakes. It took 7 years. One of the best 7 years of my life. So then I finished it. And those of you who've also read Proust will know that after you finish Proust, there comes the interval we call the desert of after Proust, because there's just nothing else like that. You want another novel to start that's exactly the same, but there isn't any other. So for a while you have recourse to, you know, biographies from the library or critical studies of Proust or writing of other people who sort of imitate Proust, but it's all futile. There's just nothing else like Proust. So eventually you settle back into the gray continuum of your life without Proust and things go on. Well, in that interval, I decided to prolong the Proust experience by doing some research on Albertine, his, you know, the girlfriend interest in the book. And I wrote up my research in 59 numbered paragraphs, which I shall read to you. I number my paragraphs for two reasons. One, it makes me feel like Wittgenstein, and two, from the point of view of you, the audience, I think, to hear the paragraphs flashing by with numbers gives a sensation of hope. The Albertine workout. One, Albertine, the name, is not a common name for a girl in France, although Albert is widespread for a boy. Two, Albertine's name occurs 2,363 times in Proust's novel, more than any other character. Three, Albertine herself is present or mentioned on 807 pages of Proust's novel. 4. On a good 19% of these pages, she is asleep. 5. Albertine is believed by some critics, including André Gide, to be a disguised version of Proust's chauffeur, Alfred Agostinelli. This is called the transposition theory. 6. Albertine constitutes a romantic, psychosexual, and moral obsession for the narrator of the novel, mainly throughout volume 5 of Proust's 7-volume in the Pléiade edition work. 7. Volume 5 is called La Prisonnière in French and The Captive in English. It was declared by Roger Shattuck, a world expert on Proust, in his award-winning 1974 study, to be the one volume of the novel that a time-pressed reader may safely and entirely skip. The problems of Albertine are, from the narrator's point of view, A, lying, B, lesbianism, and from Albertine's point of view, A, being imprisoned in the narrator's house. 9. Her bad taste in music, although several times remarked on, is not a problem. 10. Albertine does not call the narrator by his name anywhere in the novel, nor does anyone else. The narrator hints that his first name might be the same first name as that of the author of the novel, that is, Marcel. Let's go with that. 11. Albertine denies she is a lesbian when Marcel questions her. 12. Her friends are all lesbians. 13. Her denials fascinate him. 14. Her friends fascinate him too, especially by their contrast with his friends, who are gay but very closeted. Her friends parade themselves at the beach and kiss in restaurants. 15. Despite intense and assiduous questioning, Marcel cannot discover what exactly it is that women do together. This palpitating specificity of female pleasure, as he calls it. 16. Albertine says she does not know. 17. Once Albertine has been imprisoned by Marcel in his house, his feelings change. It was her freedom that first attracted him, the way the wind billowed in her garments. This attraction is now replaced by a feeling of ennui, boredom. She becomes, as he says, a heavy slave. 18. This is predictable given Marcel's theory of desire, which equates possession of another person with erasure of the otherness of her mind, while at the same time positing otherness as what makes another person desirable. 19. And in point of fact, how can he possess her mind if she is a lesbian? 20. His fascination continues. 21. Albertine is a girl in a flat sports cap pushing her bicycle across the beach when Marcel first sees her. He keeps going back to this image. 22. Albertine has no family, profession, or prospects. She is soon installed in Marcel's house. There she has a separate bedroom. He emphasizes that she is nonetheless an obedient person. See above on Albertine as heavy slave. 23. Albertine's face is sweet and beautiful from the front, but from the side has a hook-nosed aspect that fills Marcel with horror. He would take her face in his hands and reposition it. 24. The state of Albertine that most pleases Marcel is Albertine asleep. 25. By falling asleep, she becomes a plant, he says. 26. Plants do not actually sleep, nor do they lie or even bluff. They do, however, expose their genitalia. 27a. Sometimes in her sleep, Albertine throws off her kimono and lies naked. 27b. Sometimes then, Marcel possesses her. 27c. Albertine appears not to wake up. 28. Marcel appears to think he is the master of such moments. 29. Perhaps he is. At this point, parenthetically, if we had time, several observations could be made about the similarity between Albertine and Ophelia, Hamlet's Ophelia, starting from the sexual life of plants, which Proust and Shakespeare equally enjoy using as a language of female desire. Albertine, like Ophelia, embodies for her lover blooming girlhood, but also castration, casualty, threat, and pure obstacle. Albertine, like Ophelia, is condemned for a voracious sexual appetite whose expression is denied her. Ophelia takes sexual appetite into the river and drowns it amid water plants. Albertine distorts hers into the false consciousness of a sleep plant. In both scenarios, the man appears to be in control of the script, yet he gets himself tangled up in the wiles of the woman. On the other hand, who is bluffing whom is hard to say. 30. Albertine's laugh has the color and smell of a geranium. 31. Marcel gives Albertine the idea that he intends to marry her, but he does not. She bores him. 32. Albertine's eyes are blue and saucy. Her hair is like crinkly black violets. 33. Albertine's behavior in Marcel's household is that of a domestic animal, which enters any door it finds open, or comes to lie beside its master on his bed, making a place for itself. Marcel has to train Albertine not to come into his room until he rings for her. 34. Marcel gradually manages to separate Albertine from all her friends, whom he regards as evil influences. 35. Marcel never says the word lesbian to Albertine. He says, "the kind of woman I object to." 36. Albertine denies she knows any such women. Marcel assumes she is lying. 37. At first, Albertine has no individuality. Indeed, Marcel cannot distinguish her from her girlfriends, or remember their names, or decide which to pursue. They form a frieze in his mind, pushing their bicycles across the beach, with the blue waves breaking behind them. 38. This pictorial multiplicity of Albertine evolves gradually into a plastic and moral multiplicity. Albertine is not a solid object. She is unknowable. When he brings his face close to hers to kiss, she is 10 different Albertines in succession. 39. One night, Albertine goes dancing with a girlfriend at the casino. 40. When questioned about this, she lies. 41. Albertine is not a natural liar. 42. Albertine lies so much and so badly that Marcel is drawn into the game. He lies too. 43. Marcel's jealousy, impotence, and desire are all exasperated to their highest pitch by the game. 44. Who is bluffing whom is hard to say. See above on Hamlet. 45. Near the end of Volume 5, Albertine finally runs away, vanishing into the night and leaving the window open. Marcel fusses and fumes and writes her a letter, in which he claims he had just decided to buy her a yacht and a Rolls Royce when she disappeared. Now he will have to cancel these orders. The yacht had a price tag of 27,000 francs, about $75,000, and was to be engraved at the prow with her favorite stanza of a poem by Mallarmé. 46. Albertine's death in a riding accident on page 642 of volume 5 does not emancipate Marcel from jealousy. It removes only one of the innumerable Albertines he would have to forget. The jealous lover cannot rest until he is able to touch all the points in space and time ever occupied by the beloved. 47. There is no right or wrong in Proust, says Samuel Beckett, and I believe it. The bluffing, however, remains a gray area. 48. Let's return to the transposition theory. 49. On May 30th, 1914, French newspapers reported that Alfred Agostinelli, a student aviator, fell from his machine into the Mediterranean Sea near Antibes and was drowned. Agostinelli, you recall, was the chauffeur whom Proust, in letters to friends, admitted that he not only loved but adored. Proust had bought Alfred the aeroplane, which cost 27,000 francs, about $75,000, and had had it engraved on the fuselage with a stanza of Mallarmé. Proust also paid for Alfred's flying lessons and registered him at the flying school under the name Marcel Swan. The flying school was in Monaco. In order to spy on Alfred while he was there, Proust sent another favorite manservant, whose name was Albert. 50. Compare and contrast Albertine's sudden fictional death by runaway horse with Alfred Agostinelli's sudden real-life death by runaway plane. Poignantly, both unfortunate beloveds manage to speak to his or her lover from the wild blue yonder. Agostinelli, before setting out for his final flight, had written a long letter, which Proust was heartbroken to receive the day after the plane crash. Transposed to the novel, this exit scene becomes one of the weirdest in fiction. 51. Several weeks after accepting the news that Albertine has been thrown from her horse and killed, Marcel gets a telegram. You think me dead, but I'm alive and long to see you. Affectionately, Albertine. Marcel agonizes for days about this news and debates with himself whether he could possibly resume relations with her, only to realize that the signature on the telegram has been misread by the telegraph operator. It is not from Albertine at all, but from another long-lost girlfriend whose name, Gilberte, shares its central letters with Albertine's name. 52. One only loves that which one does not entirely possess, says Marcel. 53. There are four ways Albertine is able to avoid becoming entirely possessed: by sleeping, by lying, by being a lesbian, and by being dead. 54. Only the first three of these can she bluff. 55. Proust was still correcting a typescript of La Prisonnière on his deathbed, November 1922. He was fine-tuning the character of Albertine and working into her speech certain phrases from Alfred Agostinelli's final letter. 56. It is always tricky, the question whether to read an author's work in light of his life or not. 57. Granted, the transposition theory is a graceless, intrusive, and saddening hermeneutic mechanism. In the case of Proust, it is also irresistible. Here is one final spark to be struck from rubbing Alfred against Albertine, as it were. Let's consider the stanza of poetry that Proust had inscribed on the fuselage of Alfred's plane, the same verse that Marcel promises to engrave on the prow of Albertine's yacht, from her favorite poem. He says it is four verses of Mallarmé, about a swan that finds itself frozen into the ice of a lake in winter. Swans are, of course, migratory birds. This one, for some reason, failed to fly off with its fellow swans when the time came. What a weird and lonely shadow to cast on these two love affairs, the fictional and the real. What a desperate analogy to offer of the lover's final wintry paranoia of possession. As Hamlet says to Ophelia, accurately but ruthlessly, "You should not have believed me." 58. Here's the stanza of Mallarmé in English. A swan of olden times remembers that it is he, the one magnificent but without hope of setting himself free, for he failed to sing of a region for living when barren winter burned all around him with ennui. 59. Everything, indeed, is at least double. La Prisonnière, page 362. Okay, the reading should be over, but here's what I think. Most of you have to drive a way long way to get home, so I want you to be in a good mood when you go. So we're going to close with two short talks. What is a short talk, you might ask? A short talk is a 13-second lecture on this or that topic. For example, short talk on Gertrude Stein about 9:30 p.m. Look at that. Today has ended. I had no idea. So now this one is an interactive short talk, which means I do a short part, you do a short part, and it comes together to form a short meaning. So in this first one, your part is simply the word deciduous with a question mark at the end. Deciduous. 1, 2, 3.
Deciduous.
Fine. Remember your line. Short talk on reading. Some people hate reading but love to go on trips. Some people hate trips but love to read. Funny how often these find themselves passengers in the same automobile. I glimpse the stupendous clear-cut shoulders of the Rockies from between paragraphs of Madame Bovary. Cloud shadows roved languidly across her huge rock throat, traced her fur flanks. And since those days, I do not look at hair on female flesh without thinking. See how that works. Okay, I'm going to do one more. This one's a little more challenging. There's two different parts for you. So we'll have chorus A and chorus B. Chorus A, your line is, "Let's buy it!" Exclamation mark. 1, 2, 3.
Let's buy it!
Fine. Chorus B, your line is, "What a bargain!" Exclamation mark. 1, 2, 3.
What a bargain!
Okay, buddy, ready? Short talk on the sensation of aeroplane takeoff. Well, you know, that could be true love running towards my life with its arms up yelling,
"Let's buy it! What a bargain!"
Thank you and good night.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.